purpose, which many guessed at, but none knew, except that all know a man does not leave his own land for nothing and with no hope of private gain. Now he stood very tall and grim about the mouth, his eyes sunken in his weathered face, and he began to speak. He told of the poor in Yuen's land, and of the famines, and of how in places girl babes were killed at birth, and how the people lived in hovels, and he told filthy, gruesome tales. And Yuen heard them all. Then the man began to show his pictures, pictures of the things he said he had seen himself. Now Yuen saw beggars whining at him from the screen, and lepers with their faces eaten off, and starving children, their bellies swollen, though empty. And there were narrow, crowded streets, and men carrying loads too great for beasts. There were such evils shown as Yuen had not seen in all his sheltered life. At the end, the man said solemnly, "You see how our gospel is needed in this sad land? We need your prayers. We need your gifts." Then he sat down. But Yuen could not bear it. All through the hour his anger had been rising, mixed with shame and dismay, so to see revealed before this staring, ignorant foreign crowd his country's faults, and more than faults, for he had not himself seen the things this man had told of, and it seemed to him that this prying priest had searched out every ill that he could find, and dragged it forth before the cold eyes of this Western world. It was only greater shame to Yuen that at the end the man begged for money for those whom he disclosed thus cruelly. Yuen's heart broke with anger. He leaped to his feet, he clenched his hands upon the seat in front of him, and he cried loudly, his eyes burning black, his cheeks red, his body trembling. "These are lies this man has told and shown. There are not such things in my country. I myself have never seen these sights. I have not seen those lepers. I have not seen starved children like those, nor houses like those. In my home there are a score of rooms, and there are many houses like mine. This man has shaped lies to tease your money from you. I speak for my country. We do not want this man, nor do we want your money. We need nothing from you." So Yuen shouted, and then he set his lips to keep from weeping and sat down again. And the people sat in great silence and astonishment at what had happened. As for the man, he listened, smiling thinly, and then he rose and said, mildly enough, "I see this young man is a modern student. Well, young man, all I can say is that I have lived among the poor, like these I have shown, for more than half my life. When you go back to your own country, come into the little city in the inland where I live, and I will show you all these things. Shall we close with prayer?" But Yuen could not stay for such mockery of praying. He rose and went out and stumbled through the streets to his own room. Soon behind him came the footsteps of others who went homeward too, and here was the final stab which Yuen had that night. Two men passed him, not knowing who he was, and he heard one say, "Queer thing that Chinese fella getting up like that, wasn't it? Wonder which of 'em was right?" And the other said, "Both of 'em, I reckon. It's safest not to believe all you hear from anybody. But what does it matter what those foreign folks are? It isn't anything to us." And the man yawned, and the other man said carelessly, "That's right. Looks like rain tomorrow, doesn't it?" And so they went their way. Then Yuen, hearing this, was somehow more wounded than if the men had cared. It seemed to him they should have cared, even if the priest had been right. But since he told lies, they should have cared to know the truth. He went angry to his bed and lay and tossed and wept a little for very anger's sake, and vowed he would do something yet to make these people know his country great. After such a thing as this, Yuen's new friend assuaged him. He took sound comfort in this simple country youth, and poured out his beliefs in his own people to him, and told him of the sages who had shaped the noble minds of his ancestors, and framed the systems whereby men lived to this day, so that in that far lovely country there was not such wantonness and willfulness as was to be found here. There men and women walked in decency and ordered goodness, and beauty grew from out their goodness. They did not need laws, such as were written in these foreign lands, where even children must be protected by a law, and women sheltered under law. In his country, Yuan said earnestly, and he believed it, there needed not to be such laws, for children were harmed by none. For none there would harm a child, he said, forgetting for the moment the foundlings even his lady mother had told him of. And he said women were always safe and honored in their homes. When the white lad asked, "So it is not true they bind women's feet?" Yuan replied proudly, "It was an old, old custom, like the one of yours when women bound their waists, and now it is long past and no more to be seen anywhere." So Yuan stood in defense of his own land, and this was now his cause. It made him think of Meng sometimes, and now he could value Meng at his true worth, and to himself he thought, "Meng was right. Our country has been defamed and brought so low we ought all to come to her support now. I shall tell Meng he saw more truly after all than I did." And he wished he knew where Meng was, that he might write and tell him this. He could write to his father, and so he did. And now Yuan found he could write more kindly and more fully than he ever had. This new love for his country made him love his family more, too, and he wrote, saying, "I long often to come home, for no country seems as good to me as my own. Our ways are best, our food the best. As soon as I return, I will come gladly home again. I stay here only that I may learn what is to be learned and use it for our country." And when he had said after this the usual words of courtesy from son to father, he sealed and stamped the letter and went out upon the street to drop it in a box put there for such purpose. It was an evening of a weekly holiday, and all the lights were lit in the shops, and young men were rollicking and roaring out songs that they knew, and girls laughed and shouted with them. Yuan, seeing all this savage show, drew down his lips in a cold smile, and he let his thoughts follow after his letter into the dignity and stillness where his father lived alone in his own courts. At least his father was surrounded by hundreds of his own men, and at least he, a warlord, lived honorably according to his code. Yuan seemed to see the tiger again as he had often seen him, sitting stately in his great carved chair, the tiger skin behind him, before him the copper brazier of burning coals, and all his guard about him, a very king. Then Yuan, in the midst of all the clattering ribaldry, the loud voices and the rude, unmelodious music streaming out of dancing places, took greater pride in his own kind than he ever had before. He withdrew himself and went again alone into his room, and fell upon his books most resolutely, feeling himself above all such men as were about him, and that he came of old and kingly origin. This was the third step he took in hatred. The fourth step came soon, and from a different, nearer cause, and it was a thing Yuan's new friend did. The friendship between these two grew less warm than it was, and Yuan's talk grew cool and distant, always of work and of the things they heard their teacher say. And this was because Yuan knew now that often when Jim came to the house where he lived, he came not to see Yuan, but to see that daughter of his landlady. The thing had begun easily enough. Yuan one evening had brought his new friend to his room, since the day was wet, and they could not go together to walk as their growing habit was. When they entered the house there was the sound of music from a front room, and the door stood ajar. It was the landlady's daughter who made the music, and be sure she knew the door was open. But as he passed, Jim looked in and saw the girl, and she saw him and cast him one of her looks, and he caught it and whispered to Yuan, "Why didn't you tell me you had such a peach here?" Yuan saw his leering look and could not bear it, and he answered gravely, "I do not understand you." But though he did not understand the word, he understood all else, and he felt a great discomfort in him. Afterwards he thought of it more gently and told himself he would not remember it, nor let so small a thing as that maid come to mar his friendship, since in this country such things were lightly considered. But the second time this happened, or that he knew it happened, Yuan was so cut he could have wept. He came late one night, having eaten his night meal away, in order that his work might go on among the books. and when he came in he heard Jim's voice in a room used in common by them all. Now Yuan, being very weary and his very eyes aching with the long reading of the Western books, whose lines run to and fro across the page, and thus weary very much eyes used to lines from top to bottom, was glad to hear his friend's voice, and he longed for an hour's companionship. He pushed open the door, therefore, which was ajar, and cried out gladly and with unwonted freedom in his manner, "I am back, Jim. Shall we go upstairs?" There in that room he saw only these two. Jim, in his hand a box of sweets at whose wrappings he was fumbling, a silly smile upon his face, and opposite him in a deep chair, lying in loose grace, the maid. When she saw Yuan come in, she looked up at him and tossed back her curly, coppery hair and said teasingly, "He came to see me this time, Mr. Wang." And then seeing the look between the two men, how the dark blood came slowly into Yuan's cheeks, and how his face, which had been all open and eager, grew closed and smooth and silent, and how on the other's face a bright red shone out, and how hostile that one looked as though he did a thing he could do if he liked, she cried petulantly, waving her pretty red-tipped hand, "Of course, if he wants to go." A silence hung between the two men, and the girl laughed, and then Yuan said gently and quietly, "Why should he not do what he likes?" He would not look again at Jim, but he went upstairs and carefully closed his door, and sat down for a while upon his bed, and wondered at the jealous pain and anger in his heart. And most of all, his heart was sick, because he could not forget the silly look upon Jim's plain, good face, and Yuan was revolted at that look. Thereafter he turned yet more proud. He told himself these white men and women were the loosest, lustiest race he ever heard of, and their whole inner thoughts were turned to each other wantonly. And when he thought this, there rushed into his mind 100 of the pictures in the theaters where they loved to go, the pictures blazoned on the highways of things to sell, and always of some woman half unclothed. He could not, he thought bitterly, come back at night and not see an evil sight in any dark corner. Some man who held a woman against him, their arms locked, hands touching in an evil way. Of such sights the town was full, and Yuan sickened at it all, and his very stomach turned proud within him at such coarseness everywhere. Thereafter he was never so near to Jim. When he heard Jim's voice in the house somewhere, he went silently alone up the stairs to his own room, and fell to his books, and he was formal in his speech if Jim came in after a while. And very often he did so because, in some strange way Yuan could not understand, his feeling for the maid was no hindrance to his old friendship for Yuan, so that he was as hearty in his way and seemed not to see Yuan's silence and aloofness. Sometimes, it is true, Yuan forgot the maid, and let himself go free again in good talk, and even jesting gently. But at least now he waited first for Jim to come to him. The old eager going out to meet him was no longer possible. Yuan said quietly to himself, "I am here if he wants me. I am not changed to him. Let him seek me if he wants me." But he was changed. For all he said, he was not. He was alone again. To assuage himself, Yuan began now to notice everything he did not like about this town and school, and every small thing he did not like came to fall like a sword cut upon his raw heart. He heard the clatter of the foreign tongue among the crowds upon the street, and he thought how harsh the voices were, and the syllables, and not smooth and like the running waters of his own tongue. He marked the careless looks of students and their stammering speech before their teachers oftentimes, and he grew more jealous of himself, and more careful even than he had been, and planned his own speech more perfectly, even though it was foreign to him, and he did his own work more perfectly than they did, and for his country's sake. Without knowing it, he came to despise this race, because he wanted to despise them. And yet he could not but envy them their ease and wealth and place, and these great buildings and the many inventions they had made, and all they had learned of the magic of air and wind and water and lightning. Yet their very wisdom and his very admiration made him like these people less. How had they stolen to such a place of power as this? And how could they be so confident of their own power, and not know even how he hated them? One day he sat in the library, poring over a certain very wonderful book, which marked out clearly for him how generations of plants could be foretold before even the seed was put into the ground, because the laws of their growth were known so clearly. And this thing was so astonishing to Yuan, so far above men's usual knowledge, that he could not but cry out secret admiration in his heart. And yet he thought most bitterly, "We have in our own country been sleeping in our beds, the curtains drawn, thinking it still night and all the world asleep with us. But it has long been day, and these foreigners have been awake and working. Shall we ever find what we have lost in all these years?" Thus Yuan fell into great secret despairs in those 6 years, and these despairs put into him what the tiger had begun, and Yuan determined that he would throw himself into his country's cause as he never had, and he came to forget after a while that he was himself. He walked and talked among these foreigners, and saw himself no longer as one Wang Yuan, but he saw himself as his people, and one who stood for his whole race in a foreign, alien land. Chapter 15. There was only Sheng, who could make Yuan feel young and not full of his mission. Sheng would not once in all the 6 years leave that great city he had chosen to live in. He said, "Why should I leave this place? There is more here than I can learn in a lifetime. I would rather know this place well than many places a little. If I know this city, then I know this people, for this city is the mouthpiece of the whole race." So because Sheng would not come to Yuan, and yet he would see Yuan, Yuan could not withstand his letters full of graceful, playful pleading. And so it came about that these two spent their summers in the city together, and Yuan slept in Sheng's small sitting room, and sat and listened to the varied talk that was there often. And sometimes he added to it, but more often he kept silence, because Sheng soon saw how narrow Yuan's life was, and that he lived too much alone, and he did not spare Yuan what he thought. With a new sharpness that Yuan did not know was in him, Sheng told Yuan all he ought to know and see, and he said, "We in our country have worshipped books. You see where we are. But these people care less for books than any race on earth does. They care for the goods of life. They do not worship scholars, they laugh at them. Half their jokes are told of their teachers, and they pay them less than their servants are paid. Shall you then think to learn the secrets of this people from these old men alone? And is it well enough to learn of only a farmer's son? You are too narrow-hearted, Yuan. You set yourself on one thing, one person, one place, and miss all else. Less than any people are these people to be found in their books. They gather books from all the world here in their libraries, and use them as they use stores of grain or gold. Books are only materials for some plan they have. You may read 1,000 books, Yuan, and learn nothing of the secret of their prosperity." Such things he said over and over to Yuan, and Yuan was very humble before Sheng's ease and wisdom, and he asked at last, "Then what ought I to do, Sheng, to learn more?" And Sheng said, "See everything, go everywhere, know all the kinds of people that you can. Let that small plot of land rest for a while, and let books be. I have sat here listening to what you have learned. Now come, and let me show you what I have learned." And Sheng looked so worldly, so sure in the way he sat and spoke, and waved the ashes from his cigarette and smoothed down his shining black hair with his graceful ivory-colored hand, that Yuan was abashed before him, and felt himself as raw a bumpkin as a man could be. It seemed to him, in truth, that Sheng knew far more than he did in everything. How much Sheng had changed from the slender, dreamy, pretty youth he had been. In the few years he had grown quick and vivid, he had bloomed forth into sureness of his beauty and faith in himself. Some heat had forced him. In the electric air of this new country, his indolence was gone. He moved, he spoke, he laughed as these others did. Yet with this vividness were still left the grace and ease and inwardness of his own race and kind. And Yuan, seeing all that Sheng now was, thought surely there was never any man like him for beauty and for brilliance. He asked in great humility, "Do you still write the verses and the tales you did?" And Sheng answered gaily, "I do, and more than I did. I have a group of poems now that I may make into a book, and I have hope of a prize or two for some tales I wrote." This Sheng said not too proudly, but with the confidence of one who knows himself well. Yuan was silent. It seemed to him indeed that he had done very little. He was as cloddish as he had been when he came. He had no friends. All he could point to for his life these many months was a pile of notebooks and some seedling plants upon a strip of earth. Once he asked Sheng, "What will you do when we go home again? Shall you always live there in the city?" This Yuan asked to feel and see if Sheng were troubled as he was by his own people's lack. But Sheng answered gaily and very surely, "Oh, always. I cannot live elsewhere." The truth is, Yuan, and we may say it here, what we cannot say before strangers, except in such cities there is no other fit place for men like us to live in our country. Where else can one find amusements fit for intelligence to enjoy? And where else cleanliness enough to live in? The little I remember of our village is enough to make me loathe it. The people filthy and the children naked in summer, and the dogs savage and everything all black with flies. You know what it is. I cannot, will not, live elsewhere than in the city. After all, these Western peoples have something to teach us in the way of comfort and of pleasure. Meng hates them, but I don't forget that left alone for centuries we didn't think of running clean water, or of electricity or motion pictures or any of these things. For me, I mean to have all good that I can, and I shall live my life where it is best and easiest and make my poems."
"That is to live it selfishly," said Yuan bluntly.
"Have it so," Sheng answered coolly. "But who is not selfish? We are all selfish. Meng is selfish in his very cause. That cause! Look at its leaders, Yuan, and dare to say they are not selfish. One was a robber once. One has shifted back and forth to this winning side and that. How does the third one live except upon the very money he collects for his cause? No, to me it is more honorable to say straightly, I am selfish. I take this for myself. I take my comfort. So be it that I am selfish. But also, I am not greedy. I love beauty. I need a delicacy about me and my house and circumstances. I will not live poorly. I only ask enough to surround myself with peace and beauty and a little pleasure."
"And your countrymen who have no peace or pleasure?" Yuan asked, his heart seething in him.
"Can I help it?" Sheng replied. "Has it not been for centuries that the poor are born, and famines come and wars break out, and shall I be so silly as to think that in my one life I can change it all? I would only lose myself in struggle, and in losing myself, my noblest self, this me. Why should I struggle against a people's fate? I might as well leap in the sea to make it dry up into productive land."
Yuan could not answer such smoothness. That night he could only lie a while after Sheng had gone to sleep and listen to the thunder of that vast, changing city beating against the very walls against which he lay. Thus listening, he grew afraid. His mind's eye, seeing through this little narrow wall of security between him and the strange, dark, roaring world beyond, saw too much, and he could not bear his smallness. And he clung to the good sense of Sheng's words, and to the warmth of the room lighted by the streetlight, and to the table and the chairs and the common things of life. There was this little spot of safety in the thousand miles of change and death and unknown life. Strange how Sheng's sure choice of safety and of ease could make Yuan feel his dreams so great they were foolish to him. So long as he was near Sheng, Yuan was not himself somehow, not brave or full of hate even, but a child seeking certainty. But Yuan could not always be thus closely and alone with Sheng. Sheng knew many in the city, and he went dancing many a night with any maid he could, and Yuan was alone even though he went with Sheng. At first he sat on the edge of all the merriment, wondering and half envious of Sheng's beauty and his friendly manner, and his boldness with a woman. Sometimes he wondered if he might follow, and then after a while he saw something which made him walk away, and swear he would not speak to any woman. And here was the reason. The women Sheng made friends with in this fashion were women not often of his own race. They were white women, or they were mixed in blood, and partly dark and partly white. Now Yuan had never touched one of these women. He could not, for some strange reason of the flesh. He had seen them often in the evenings when he had gone with Ai Lan, for in the coastal city people of every hue and shade mingled freely. But he had never taken one to him to dance with her. For one thing, they dressed in such a way as to him seemed shameless, for their backs were bare, and so bare that a man in dancing must place his hand on bare white flesh, and this he could not do, because it made a sickness rise in his blood. Yet now there was another reason why he would not. For as he watched Sheng and all the women who smiled and nodded when he came near them, it seemed to Yuan that only certain women smiled, and that the best, less shameless ones looked sidewise or away from Sheng when he came near, and gave themselves only to the men of their own kind. The more Yuan looked, the more true this seemed, and it even seemed to him that Sheng knew this too, and that he only took the ones whose smiles were sure and easy. And Yuan grew deeply angry for his cousin's sake, and somehow for his own sake and for his country's sake, although he did not understand fully why the women so behaved, and he was too shy and fearful of hurting Sheng to mention it. And he muttered in his own heart, "I wish Sheng were proud and would not dance with them at all. If he is not held good enough for the best of them, I wish he would scorn them all." And then Yuan was in an agony of hurt, because Sheng was not proud enough and took his pleasure anyhow. Here was a strange thing, that all Meng's angers against foreigners had not moved Yuan to hatred. But now, seeing these proud women who looked sideways when Sheng came near, Yuan felt that he could hate them, and then that he did, and that because of these few he could hate all their kind. Then Yuan often went away and would not stay to see Sheng scorned, and he spent his nights alone, at books, or staring into sky or into city streets, and into the questions and confusions of his heart. Patiently through these summers, Yuan followed Sheng hither and thither in his life in that city. Sheng's friends were many. He could not go into the restaurant where commonly he bought his food without some man or maid calling out most heartily, "Hello, Johnny!" For this was what they called him. The first time Yuan heard it, he was shocked at such freedom. He murmured to Sheng, "How do you bear this common name?" But Sheng only laughed and answered, "You should hear what they call each other. I am only glad they call me by so mild a name as this. Besides, they do it in friendship, Yuan. The ones they like best, they speak of with the greatest freedom." And indeed it could be seen that Sheng had many friends. Into his room at night they came, twos and threes of friends, and sometimes twice as many. Piled together on Sheng's bed or on the floor, smoking and talking, these young men strove each with the other to see who could think the wildest, quickest thoughts, and who could first confound what another had just said. Yuan never had heard such motley talk. Sometimes he thought them rebels against the government and feared for Sheng, until by some new wind the whole several hours' talk might veer away from this and end in the cheerfulest acceptance of what was and in great scorn of any newness. And then these young men, reeking of their smoke and of the stuff they brought to drink, would shout their partings, grinning and content and with the mightiest relish for themselves and all the world. Sometimes they talked of women boldly, and Yuan, silent on a theme he knew so little of, for what did he know except the touch of one maid's hand, sat listening, sick at what he heard. When they were gone, he said to Sheng most gravely, "Can all we hear be true, And are there such evil, forward women as they say? Are all the women of this nation so? No chaste maids, no virtuous wives, no woman unassailable? Then Sheng laughed teasingly and answered, They are very young, these men, only students like you and me. And what do you know of women, Yuan? And Yuan answered humbly, It is true I do know nothing of them. Yet thereafter Yuan looked more often at these women whom he saw so freely on the streets. They too were part of these people, but he could make nothing of them. They walked quickly, were gay in garb, and their faces were painted as gaily. Yet when their sweet, bold eyes fell on Yuan's face, the look was empty. They stared at him a second and passed on. To them he was not a man, only a stranger passing by. Not worth the effort that a man was worth, their eyes said. And Yuan, not understanding this fully, yet felt the coldness and the emptiness, and was shy to his soul. They moved so arrogantly, he thought, so coldly sure of their own worth, that he feared them greatly. Even in passing he took care not to touch one of them heedlessly in any way, lest anger come forth from the casual moment. For there was a shape to their reddened lips, a boldness in the way they held their shining heads, a swing their bodies had, which made him shrink away. He felt no lure of woman in them, yet they did add their magic of living color to the city. For after days and nights Yuan could see why Sheng said these people were not in their books. One could not, Yuan perceived, his face upturned to the distant golden peak of one great building, put such a thing as that in books. At first Yuan had seen no beauty in their buildings, his eye being trained to quiet latitudes of low-tiled roofs and gentle slopes of houses. But now he saw beauty, foreign beauty, it was true, yet beauty. And for the first time since he had come to this land, he felt a need to write a verse. One night in his bed, while Sheng slept, he struggled to shape his thoughts. Rhymes would not do, not usual quiet rhymes, the rhymes he once had made of fields and clouds. He needed sharp words, rough-edged and cleanly pointed. The words of his own tongue he could not use, they were so round and smooth with long polished use. No, he must search out other words in this newer foreign tongue. And yet they were like new tools to him, too heavy for his own wielding, and he was not accustomed to their form and sound. And so at last he gave it up. He could not shape the verse, and there it lay unshaped in his mind to make him a little restless for a day or two, and longer, because at last he came to feel that if he could but shape it out of him, he could have caught between his hands the meaning of these people. But he could not. They kept their souls away from him, and he moved only here and there among their swift bodies. Now Sheng and Yuan were two very different souls. Sheng's soul was like the rhymes which flowed so easily out from it. He showed these rhymes to Yuan one day, beautifully written on thick paper edged with gold, and said with pretended carelessness, They are nothing, of course, not my best work. That I shall do some later day. These are only fragments of this country, put down as they came to me, but my teachers gave me praise for them. Yuan read them carefully, one by one, in silence and reverence. To him they seemed beautiful, each word well chosen, fitted to its place as neatly as a stone set in a ring of gold, embossed with gold. There were some of these verses, Sheng said lightly, which had even been set to music by a certain woman whom he knew. One day, after he had spoken a time or two of this woman, he took Yuan to her home to hear the music she had made of Sheng's verses. And here Yuan saw another sort of woman still, and still another life of Sheng's. She was a singer in some hall, not quite a common singer, but still not so great by far as she conceived herself to be. She lived alone in a house where many others lived, each in his own little home in the great house. The room which she had made for herself to live in was dark and still. Although outside the sun shone brightly, no sun came here. Candles burned in tall bronze stands. The scent of incense hung heavily upon the thick air. There was no seat hard or uncushioned, and at one end a great divan stretched. Here on this bed the woman lay, a long, fair woman, whose age was inscrutable to Yuen. She cried out when she saw Sheng, waving a holder that she held to smoke by, and she said, "Sheng, darling, I haven't seen you in ages." When Sheng sat easily beside her, as though he had sat there many times before, she cried again, and her voice was deep and strange and not like a woman's voice. "That lovely thing of yours, Temple Bells, I've finished it. I was just going to call you up." When Sheng said, "This is my cousin, Yuen," she scarcely looked at Yuen. She was rising as Sheng spoke, her long legs careless as a child's, and with the holder in her mouth she flung a twisted word or two. "Oh, hello, Yuen." And seeming not to see him, went to the instrument she had and laying down the thing from out her mouth, began to slide her fingers slowly from one handful of notes to another. Deep, slow notes such as Yuen did not know. Soon she began to sing, her voice deep as the music her hands made, shaking a little, very passionately. The thing she sang was short, a little verse of Sheng's he had once written in his own country, but the music changed it somehow. For Sheng had shaped the words wistfully and slightly as bamboos shadowed in the moonlight on a temple wall. But this foreign woman singing these pretty little words made them passionate, the shadows black and hard, the moonlight hot. And Yuen was troubled, feeling the frame of music was too heavy for the picture the words made. But so the woman was. Every movement she made was full of troubled meaning, every word and every look not simple. Suddenly Yuen did not like her. He did not like the room she lived in. He did not like her eyes too dark for the fairness of her hair. He did not like her looks at Sheng, nor how she called him by the name of Darling many times, nor how, when she had made the music, she walked about and touched Sheng often as she passed him, nor how she brought the music to him written down and leaned over him and once even laid her cheek against his hair and murmured in her casual, negligent fashion, "Your hair is not painted on, is it, darling? It shines so smoothly always." And Yuen, sitting in completest silence, felt some gorge in him rise against this woman, some healthy gorge his old grandfather had given him, and his father, too. A simple knowledge that what this woman did and said and how she looked were not seemly. He looked to Sheng to repulse her, even gently to repulse her, but Sheng did not. He did not touch her, it is true, or answer her words with like words, or in any way put out his hand to meet her hand. But he accepted what she did and said. When her hand lay upon his for an instant, he let it lie, and did not draw away from her as Yuen wished he would. When she sent her gaze into his eyes, he looked back, half laughing but accepting all her boldness and her flattery, until Yuen could scarcely stomach what he saw. He sat as large and stolid as an image, seeming to see nothing and hear nothing, until Sheng rose. Even then the woman clung to his arm with her two hands, coaxing Sheng to come to some dinner that she gave, saying, "Darling, I want to show you off, you know. Your verses are something new. You're something new yourself. I love the Orient. The music's rather nice, too, isn't it? I want the crowd to hear it. Not too many, you know. Only a few poets and that Russian dancer. Darling, here's an idea. She could do a dance to the music, a sort of Oriental thing. Your verses would be divine to dance to. Let's try it." So she continued coaxing until Sheng took her two hands in his own and put them down and promised what she wished, seeming reluctant, yet, as Yuen could see, only seeming. When they were out away from her at last, Yuen breathed in a time or two and out again, and looked about him gladly at the honest sunshine. They two were silent for a while, Yuen fearing to speak lest he offend Sheng in what he thought, and Sheng absorbed in some thinking of his own, a little smile upon his face. At last Yuen said, half trying Sheng, "I never heard such words upon a woman's tongue before. I scarcely know such words. Does she then love you so well?" But Sheng laughed at this and answered, "Those words mean nothing. She uses them to any man. It is a way such women have. The music is not bad, though. She gets my mood." And Yuan, looking now at Sheng, saw on his face a look Sheng did not know was there. It was a look which plainly said that Sheng somehow liked those sweet and idle words the woman had said, and he liked her praise of him, and liked the flattery of his verses which her music made. Yuan said no more then, but to himself he said that Sheng's way was not his, nor Sheng's life his, and his own way for him was best, though what his way was he scarcely knew, except it was not this way. Therefore, though Yuan stayed on a while in that city and its sights to please his cousin, and saw its subterranean trains and all the streets of show, he knew that in spite of what Sheng said, not all of life was here. His own life was not here. He was lonely. There was nothing here that he knew or understood, or so he thought. Then one day, when it was very hot, and Sheng was indolent with heat and lay asleep, Yuan wandered forth alone, and riding on a public vehicle or two, he came into a region he had not dreamed was here in such a city. For he had been surfeited with its richness. To him the buildings were palaces, and every man took for matter of course that he had all he would of food and drink and garments, and his needs were not for these things, for they were his due and only to be expected. Beyond these were the needs of pleasure and of better garments and food made not to live by, but to take zest in. Thus were all the citizens of this city, or so it seemed to Yuan. But upon this day he found himself in another city, a city of the poor. He stumbled on it, unknowing, and suddenly it was everywhere about him. These were the poor. He knew them. Though their faces were pale and white, though some were black-skinned as the savages are, he knew them. By their eyes, by the filth upon their bodies, by their dirty, scaly hands, by the loud screams of women and the cries of too many children, he knew them. There in his memory were the other poor he knew, very far away in another city, but how like these? He said to himself, recognizing them, "Then this great city, too, is built upon a city of the poor." Ailan and her friends came out at midnight into such men and women as these were. Yuan thought to himself, and with a sort of triumph, "These people, too, hide their poor. In this rich city, crowded secretly into these few streets, are these poor, as filthy as any to be seen in any country." Here, then, Yuan truly found something not in books. He walked among these people in a daze, staring into narrow, shadowed rooms, choosing his footsteps among the garbage of the streets, where starved children ran half-naked in the heat. Lifting up his head to look at misery on misery, he thought, "It does not matter that they live in lofty houses. They live in hovels still, the same hovels." He went back at last, when darkness fell, and entered into the cool, lit darkness of the other streets. When he came into Sheng's room, Sheng was gay again, awake, and ready with a friend or two to sally forth into the street of theaters to make merry there. When he saw Yuan, he cried out, "Where have you been, cousin? I nearly feared you lost." And Yuan answered slowly, "I have seen some of the life you told me was not in the books. Then all the wealth and strength of these people still cannot keep away the poor." And he told where he had been and a little of what he saw. And one of Sheng's friends said, careful as a judge, "Some day, of course, we will solve the problem of poverty." And the other said, "Of course, if these people were capable of more, they would have more. They are defective somehow. There is always room at the top." Then Yuan spoke out quickly, "The truth is, you hide your poor. You are ashamed of them as a man is ashamed of some secret vile disease." But Sheng said gaily, "We'll be late if we let this cousin start us on this talk. The play begins in half an hour." Chapter 16. In those 6 years, Yuan came near to three others who befriended him among all the strangers among whom he lived. There was a certain old teacher he had, a white-haired man, whose face Yuan early liked to see because it was very kindly marked by gentle thoughts and perfect ways of life. To Yuan this old man showed himself, when time went on, as more than a teacher only. He spent willingly much time in special talk with Yuan, and he read the notes Yuan wrote in planning for a book he hoped to write, and with very mild correction he pointed out a place or two where Yuan was wrong. Whenever Yuan spoke, he listened, his blue eyes so smiling and so filled with understanding that Yuan came at length to trust him greatly, and at further length to tell him inward things. He told him, among much else, how he had seen the poor in the city, and how he wondered that in the midst of such vast riches the poor could live so desperately. And this led him on to talk of the foreign priest, and how he had besmirched Yuan's people by his vile pictures. The old man listened to it all in his mild, silent way, and then he said, "I think not everyone can see the whole picture. It has long been said we each see what we look for. You and I, we look at land and think of seed and harvests. A builder looks at the same land and thinks of houses, and a painter of its colors. The priest sees men only as those who need to be saved, and so naturally he sees most clearly those who need to be saved." And after Yuan had thought of this a while, unwillingly he knew it to be true, and in all fairness he could not quite hate the foreign priest as wholly as he did, or even as he wished he could. For still he thought him wrong, and still he said, "At least he saw a very narrow part of my country." To which the old man answered always mildly, "That might be, but must be if he were a narrow man." Through talk like this in field and schoolroom after others had gone home, Yuan learned to love this old white man, and he loved Yuan and looked on him with increasing tenderness. One day he said to Yuan, half-hesitating, "I wish you would come with me tonight, my son. We are very simple folk, only my wife and my daughter Mary and I, we three. But if you will come and take your supper with us, we'll be glad. I've told them so much about you. They want to know you too." This was the first time anyone had spoken thus to Yuan in these years, and he was very moved by it. It seemed a warm and special thing to him that a teacher would take a pupil to his private home. He said shyly, therefore, in the courteous way of his own tongue, "I am not worthy." To which the old man opened his eyes wide and smiled and said, "Wait till you see how plain we are. My wife said when I first told her it would be a pleasure to me if you came, 'I'm afraid he's used to much better than we have.'" Then Yuan protested again in courtesy and yielded. Thus he found himself walking down the shaded street into a small, square, court-like yard, and thence to an ancient wooden house, standing back in trees and set about with porches. There at the door a lady met him who made him think of the lady whom he called his mother. For in these two women, 10,000 miles apart, who spoke two different tongues, whose blood and bones and skin were not alike, there was yet a common look. The white smoothed hair, their full settled look of motherhood, their simple ways and honest eyes, their quiet voices, the wisdom and the patience graven on their lips and brows, these made them like. Yet it was true there was a difference in the two which Yuan could perceive after they were seated in the large main room, for about this lady there was an air of contentment and simple satisfaction of the soul which his lady mother had not. It was as if this one had her heart's desire in her lifetime, but the other had not. By two roads the two had come to a good, tranquil age, but the one had come by a happy road and with companionship, while the other had come by a darker way, and she walked alone. But when this lady's daughter came in, she was not like Ailan. No, this Mary was a different sort of maid. She was, perhaps, a little more in years than Ailan was, much taller and not so pretty, very quiet seemingly, and governed in her face and look. Yet when one listened to the words she spoke, there was sense in all she said, and her dark gray-black eyes, somber in hue when she was grave, could flash out merrily to match a witty twist her words might take. She was demure before her parents, yet not afraid, and they deferred to her as to an equal, and Yuan perceived this. Indeed, Yuan saw very soon she was no common maid, For when the old man talked of what Yuen wrote, this Mary knew of it too, and put a question so quickly and so aptly before Yuen that he was taken aback and asked her, wondering, "How is it that you know the history of my people so well, that you can ask me of one so far away in history as Chao Tso?" To this the maid answered modestly, but with a shine of smiling in her eyes, "Oh, I have always had a kinship with your land, I think. I have read books about it. Shall I tell you the very little I know about him? Then you will know I am a sham. I really know nothing. But he wrote about agriculture, didn't he? In an essay. I remember I memorized a bit I read once in a translation. It was something like this. Crime begins in poverty, poverty in insufficiency of food, insufficiency in neglect of tilling of the soil. Without such tilling, man has no tie to bind him to the soil. Without such a tie, he readily leaves his birthplace and his home. Then he is like the birds of the air or the beasts of the field, neither battlemented cities nor deep moats, nor harsh laws nor cruel punishments can subdue this roving spirit that is strong within him." These words, which Yuen knew very well, this maid now chanted in a round, clear voice, for her voice was very full of meaning. It could be seen she loved the words, because a gravity came upon her face and into her eyes a mystery, as of one who again perceives beauty known before. Her parents listened reverently and in pride while she spoke, and the old father turned to Yuen as one who cries out in his heart, only keeping back the words in decent courtesy. "Do you see what my child is for wisdom and intelligence, and have you seen one like her?" Yuen could not but speak out his pleasure, and hereafter, when she spoke, he listened too, and felt a kinship with her, because whatever she said, even if she said a small thing, was said fitly and well, and as he would have liked to have said it in her place. Yet though he felt so used to this house he had entered for the first time this night, so used to these people that he forgot they were not of his kind, yet every now and again there came a strangeness of some sort, a foreign thing he did not understand. When they entered into a smaller room and sat about an oval table spread for the meal, Yuen took up his spoon to eat. But he saw the others hesitate, and then the old man bowed his head, and so did the others, except Yuen, who did not understand the thing. And while he looked from one to the other to see what would happen, the old man spoke aloud as though to some god not to be seen, a few words only, but said with feeling, as though he thanked one for a gift received. After this, without further rite, they ate, and Yuen asked nothing at that time, but he gave and received in talk. But afterwards, being very curious about this rite and never having seen it heretofore, he asked his teacher of it as they sat alone in the twilight on the wide veranda, and he asked so he might know what the courteous thing was he should do at such a time. Then the old man fell silent for a while, smoking his pipe and looking peacefully away into the shadowed street. At last he held his pipe in the cup of his hand and said, "Yuen, I have many times wondered how to speak to you of our religion. What you saw is a religious rite we have, a simple giving thanks to God for food daily set before us. In itself it is not important, and yet it is a symbol of the greatest thing our lives hold, our belief in God. Do you remember you spoke of our prosperity and power? I believe it is the fruit of our religion. I do not know what your religion is, Yuen, but I know you should not be true to my own self or to you if I should let you live here and daily come and go in my classes and come often, I hope, to my home, and not tell you of my own faith." While the old man spoke thus, the two women came out and seated themselves there, the mother on a chair in which she rocked gently to and fro, as though a wind were blowing it. There she sat, listening to her husband, a mild, agreeing smile upon her face. And when he paused for a moment, for he went on to talk of gods and mysteries of gods made human flesh, she cried out with a sort of gentle passion, "Oh, Mr. Wong, ever since Dr. Wilson told me how brilliant you are in his classes, how able in all you write, I have counted you for Christ. What a great thing it would be for your country if you could be somehow won for Christ and go back to bear good witness." This gave Yuen great astonishment, for he did not know what all these words meant. But being courteous, he smiled merely and bowed a little and was even about to speak, when Mary's voice broke out sharp and clear as metal, and with a tone Yuan had not heard in it before. She had not sat herself in a chair, but on the uppermost step, and she had sat there silent while her father had talked, holding her chin in her two hands and listening seemingly. Now out of the dim light her voice came restless, strange, impatient, cutting like a knife across the talk. "Shall we go inside, Father? The chairs will be more comfortable, and I like the light." To which the old man answered in a vague surprise, "Why, yes, Mary, if you wish. But I thought you always liked to sit here of an evening. Every night we sit here a while." But the young woman answered still more restlessly, and with a sort of willfulness, "Tonight I want the light, Father." "Very well, my dear," the old man said, and rose slowly, and so they went within. There in the lighted room he spoke no more of mysteries. Instead, his daughter led the talk, plying Yuan with 100 questions of his own country, so quick and deep sometimes that he must in all honesty confess himself confounded by his own ignorance. And while she talked, he could not but feel a pleasure in her. For though he knew she was not beautiful, her face was keen and quickened, and the skin was delicate and very white, her lips narrow and a little red, and her hair was smooth and very nearly like his own in blackness, but much finer than his was. Her eyes, he saw, were beautiful, now near black with earnestness, then changing to a lovely shining gray when she smiled, and she smiled often, though she did not laugh aloud. Her hands spoke, too, being very restless, supple, slender hands, not small and perhaps too thin and not smooth enough for beauty, but nevertheless with a sort of power in their look and movement. But Yuan took no pleasure in these things for themselves, for he saw she was one whose body seemed a thing not of itself, but only a covering for her mind and soul. And this was new to Yuan, who had known no such woman. When he thought he saw a sudden beauty in her, as suddenly it was gone, and he forgot it in the flash of light her mind sent out, or in a witty word her tongue spoke. The body was informed here by the mind, and the mind did not spend itself in thoughts upon the body. So Yuan saw